Basically, the ebook that we created covers just the very beginning of the Manchu origins myth or story, as you will. So it starts out with the three heavenly maidens coming down to bathe in a sacred lake on top of the sacred white mountain. And then one of them, the youngest, becoming impregnated by the red fruit delivered to her by a magpie, resulting in the birth of Bukuri Yongshun, who then goes on to quell conflict among, I would say, warring tribes or warring villages, and then he becomes the ruler. But our book does end on a rather sad note, because after Bukuri Yongshun had achieved all of this, then things went back into political disarray, and it ends with his descendant Fancha running away from the chaos and then honoring the magpie as an ancestor of the Manchus.
That's when the Saksaha, the magpie, shows up again.
Exactly, right. So it's very fitting with Saksaha, the journal as well, right?
Great. So so as I understand it, you taught this text in your first year Manchu class when you were a graduate student at Harvard. And then how did this idea of making this book occur to you?
Well, so it was very interesting to be asked to teach Manchu A and Manchu B. I think it's very unique to teach one's peers. So I was teaching all fellow graduate students, and I thought that I would try to make Manchu more interesting because we had a diverse group of students in the class. Not everyone was going to go on to specialize in late imperial Chinese history or Manchu history. But I thought it would actually be more interesting to have everyone learn how to write the language as well as to read it. So I think this comes from my previous training in Mongolian. So my Mongolian language teachers said, you cannot get away with simply reading Mongolian. You know, you have to actually physically move your pencil, your pen, your brush, whatever. And they were very, very critical because I'm left-handed, and they said, there's no way you can write beautifully with your left hand, but nevertheless taught me, and this was at Minzu Dashue. And I'm grateful for that. But I then tried to do the same thing with Manchu, and I said, you will understand the alphabet better if you can write it yourself and to create written Manchu. And I also thought that it would be interesting to do some work with literature rather than just with government documents. I mean, obviously for many of us, Qing government documents are the reason why we learn to read Manchu. But I said, well, you know, for an introduction, there's so much more out there. So I was inspired by Professor Zhuang Jifa, who has translated lots of folk stories and so on. And I said, well, kind of bringing together history and literature would be the Manchu origin story. So originally, looking back at my syllabus for Manchu B in 2007, the notion was that we would just translate a little bit, and then we moved on to other works of literature, and then eventually more government documents. Then things kind of spiraled in a different direction. So after we did that, it was very exciting, but that wasn't the end. So first of all, I had everyone go into a recording studio at Harvard to actually record themselves speaking Manchu. So not only reading Manchu, you know, silently for the sake of translation, but actually uttering the Manchu. So we read out the Manchu origin story. And then we started thinking about how to make the story more relevant outside of just, you know, our small circle. And so that's when the class started to think about translating the story into other languages. So we saw the Manchu original, we saw the literary Chinese, And then we said, so what would this be like if translated into modern Mandarin or modern Turkish or modern Cantonese, or Korean, so on and so forth. And so, as it were in Manchu B, we have, native, natives in all of those languages. Yeah. So each person took one language as their particular task or assignment. And then we actually recorded those translations too. Yeah. So actually I still have, you know, CDs, from the recording studio with everyone's voices reading both Manchu and another language. So it was really, really fun. And then things went dormant for a while. You know, everyone moved on to their dissertation research and then started their careers and so on. But all the while I said, well, can we do something more with this? You know, we worked so hard for this. And I think then it occurred to me that perhaps we should make something for a much broader audience. And because Bukhari Yongshun at least started out as a walking, talking child, it occurred to us that tailoring this book for children or for children and adults would be interesting. Now here I have to confess there was a big glitch in our plans. So my conception of the book, and this is beyond my technological abilities at this point, but was actually to kind of work off the idea of a multilingual text that would actually allow the user, the reader, to choose whichever languages they wanted. So that's what I had in mind, which actually stalled the project for a long time, for years, literally. So it's been about 13 years. And then finally, I decided, an epiphany, I said, well, let's give up on that. Let's try the very simple.
It's all together.
Yes, just creating an ebook, you know, in the simplest form. So as you've seen it, it's you know, not as sophisticated as what we talked about. But another problem was actually the illustrations, because there was a long debate about whether to use the illustrations from the original Qing period text or to create new ones. Mm-hmm. And so my sister, Eugenia, who is not a historian, has not studied Manchu, she said, well, you know, those pictures, those images are all right. So she saw them, but she is an information scientist, and she's also a VR media, multimedia artist. She said, but you need something more appealing to children. these are in the block print, it's not that fun. So we started doing a lot of tests with the children in our life to see what would capture their attention. So we tried different media, and then we settled on crayon, and we settled on figures that would look, you know, appealing to them, and so on and so forth. So I think adult readers may not mind so much, but we really want to target children. And here I'll also have to invoke another inspiration, which was, and I don't know if they'll remember this, but I think it was, yeah, it was also 2007, Max Oidman and Brian Tawney and Jenny Tainan and I, we were in Xinjiang, we were in the Chapchal Autonomous County with the Shiba Committee, right, community. And at that time, you know, I think if I remember correctly, none of us had children. I could be wrong about Brian. But anyway, we vowed that we would raise our children to learn to love the Manchu language, right? And Max has done a great job of that. I'm still working on that with my own three. And I think Brian has also imparted his love of Manchu. But anyway, we made a vow that there would be children who would grow up very familiar with Manchu. So this book is also dedicated to all the children of Manchu worldwide.
Came into right. our lives.
Yes, right. So, you know, something for them to read, something that's a little more accessible to them.
So what do you want them to take away from this story that is kind of a Manchu origin myth? It had a very dry kind of historical origin in the Haiqing moments. What would you like to say to future readers?
Right. Well, one thing about the process that I would like to add here is that actually one reason why we haven't featured the recordings yet is because the translations into all the other languages actually changed significantly when we took up the book project again, right? So I thought we could just take what we had done and then we would add the illustrations and focus on the technological aspects, the digitization. But in fact, all of the translators decided to edit their translation extensively, right? And I really appreciate this effort. It was immense. The number of times we went over this very, outwardly simplistic or simple text, just very meticulous edits on grammar, choice of vocabulary, everything. Yes. So, I mean, I think translation, you know, is already a complex process, but all the translators really redevoted themselves after all these years, yes, over a decade, to make this translation, I think, the best possible. So in that way, I want future readers to know that the intention is really to create these very robust bridges between Manchu and all these modern languages. So it really will translate back and forth, you know. So if you don't know Manchu, but you know one of the modern languages, you can still fully appreciate the story. If you know Manchu and one of those or more of those modern languages, you know, then you can also see how they fit perfectly together. So that took a lot of effort. I still think, you know, Bukhar Yungshan is a very interesting story. It's fantastical, unbelievable in some ways, but you know, it's also, I would say, good cartoon material. So imagine, you know, this red fruit producing
five guy carrying a child by Link.
Exactly. Right. Or we could do this live action, you know. I've always wanted to like reenact, you know, the birth of Bukhar Yungshan and how he would, you know, actually convince the people that he is, you know, a divine being and so on. Yes. And also, I don't know, your question is really important because I am curious about the current relevance of stories like this. So I used to actually, you know, be a very, I would say, naive believer of folk literature that was written down, you know, so from the oral to the written forms, in the past 50 years or so, 50, 60 years. But then 2 years ago, when I actually visited a venerable Manchu elder in Heilongjiang, and I asked him about the story, he said, "Never heard of it, don't know." I didn't mean to put him on the spot. I asked him very discreetly and so on. But I thought, you know, we could have a little chat about it to see what it meant to him. And otherwise, you know, he kept a very nice family genealogy. You know, he was a practitioner of traditional Manchu folk religion. Right. But somehow Bukhar Yungshan meant nothing to him. So I wondered, you know, I don't believe in kind of imposing these cultural elements on people, right? But I wondered if, you know, people who identify as Manchu today would actually be interested in this story of learning about it and connecting back to their, you know, putative ancestors via, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it, people can decide now, like they can encounter it as a fresh story, whether they identify with the Qing version of it or not. I think we should leave that open, right, as a as an opportunity. And then I think also the decision to go do away with the woodblock illustration also kind of enabled you to not carry on with this Qing imperial version. And then just, okay, here's the story and here's the pictures that we thought would be appealing. And how about we just read it as a tale?
Right, about imagination, really. I mean, my sister struggled because when she was doing the illustrations, she continued to ask me several times, well, do you have any samples? You know, what would people of these villages look like?
Do they have shoes? Do they wear?
Right. I said, well, I don't have any photographs, you know, I'm not going to be able to provide that kind of tangible evidence, right? So then we talked about it. Then she kept saying, you know, what kind of lifestyle would these people have? Mm-hmm. You know, who are they similar to of the people of now and so on?
Yeah. So lastly, just to wrap up this, so you work with so many languages. In what ways is Manchu still special to you and your work? What is unique for you, and what is fun for you about Manchu among so many, including many that are related to Manchu in the region? So what would you say from this point, looking back at your career, and what does Manchu mean to you?
Well, I'll try to be brief on that, because I think it means a lot, even though, as you mentioned, you know, I've gone in other directions, working with other languages since I started learning Manchu in 2001, mm-hmm. if I remember correctly. So, I mean, I think, you know, it's really just fascinating to see the influence of Manchu. And I don't mean this in, you know, the hard, cold, political, imperial way, mm-hmm. As the Qing state intended, mm-hmm. but just, you know, how resilient Manchu was a language in Northeast China after 1912, mm-hmm. and how many people of various ethnic or sociocultural backgrounds, you know, were fluent in Manchu, could read and write Manchu. They've kept genealogies in Manchu language, and so they've adopted it, you know, very much as, you know, we see in Sinophone studies with non-Han Chinese people adopting Chinese language. So I think that's great. A more superficial answer to your question would be, you know, I just love reading and writing it. So I love the look and feel of the script. So it's fun for me to write in Manchu. You know, if I teach about Qing history, you know, I write Manchu just to show them the difference, but also the elegance of this writing system, which was, you know, significant to both the state and the society of that time. So I think in that sense, it will always have this, you know, very special place mm-hmm. in my research.
So all this is really inspiring to me, and I'm sure all the readers out there will appreciate that. And then here, just to wrap up and to thank you and everyone involved in this project for creating this book and sharing it on our website.